Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 187. I'm recording it on Thursday, December 3rd, 2009. The PE10 level today is 20. Stocks are dangerous at today's prices. I wouldn't recommend going with a high stock allocation at today's prices. The music for this podcast is entitled Cheek Slap. The title of the podcast is Volatility Adds Nothing. I've been on a volatility kick. I've done a number of podcasts relating to volatility. I think that we've been through what a long, strange trip it's been, friends and neighbors. We've been through a lot over the first 7 years of our investing discussions at the Retire Early and Indexing Discussion Board communities. But I think what I've been doing over those 7 years, and what, you know, hundreds of people have contributed in a positive, constructive way to these discussions, and I sort of write up the results of the website in the podcast and in articles and blog entries and all this sort of thing. But what we've been doing is putting together pieces of the puzzle, the investing puzzle, and piece by piece. We've gained confidence over time that we're on the right track by verifying. You know, we come up with tentative findings, we do research, and verify those tentative findings, and then as you find something, you new puzzles occur to you, and you look for new pieces of the puzzle, and you click those in, and you start to get a better, more confident sense of the big picture over time. And our findings in, I don't know, the past 2 months about volatility, I think, may be the last big piece. We still have a long ways to go solving the investing problem because we still haven't gotten over that hurdle of opening up the internet to honest posting on the flaws in the buy and hold model. So we certainly need to get that. We need to share this, and we need to get to constructive feedback from, you know, hundreds, thousands, millions of people. So the journey has not come to an end, but I think this volatility question is a big piece of the puzzle, and I think this piece clicks into place very well. It's going to remain a tentative finding because it's not something we can verify just by looking at data. It's theoretical. It has to do with how stocks work. I don't know that there's any clean way of testing it with data. So we can find clues, but I don't know that we can have any final definitive answer, but it sure makes sense. It sure makes sense to me anyway, and I'd like to hear lots of other smart people chime in and see what they have to say about it. And if this is right, this is our biggest finding of all. If you're interested in the whole volatility question, I've done a series of podcasts looking at different aspects of it. One was called Volatility is Like Pollution, and I believe that that's the podcast. There was one where I had some technical problems. I think it might have been number 165. I can't swear to that. And I wasn't able to get it up. And I hope to be able to get that fixed and get that podcast up. But I believe that was the one, Volatility is Like Pollution. The argument there is that volatility is a community problem. The volatility of stocks. Most people think of stock investing as an individual, a solo act. You're just out there to get the best deal you can get, to get the best return and all this sort of thing. And you know, screw your buddy while doing it is just fine. That's not the rational investing approach. The rational investing approach is that the stock market is a resource. Just as the air we breathe is a community resource, and the ocean we swim in is a community resource, and we all good citizens need to care about these community resources, and we all need to work together to see that the stock market is not destroyed with get-rich-quick schemes like buy and hold. Buy and hold is the ultimate get-rich-quick scheme. We're opposed to that here at PassionSaving.com. While having great respect for the people who developed it, we are opposed to the model, which has been discredited by the academic research of the past 30 years. So the first one was called Volatility is Like Pollution. It made the argument that volatility is a community problem. The second one, the second big one, I believe, was called Volatility is Optional. And that's the biggest. That's really that's the one at which I felt I had enough of a grasp on the insight to be able to state it at least somewhat clearly. Volatility is optional. And boy, what do those three words ever say something important? The argument made is that we all love stocks. Any sane person loves the return. How can you not love the return on stocks? 6.5 real in the U.S.? Going back many, many years? How could anyone complain about the return? But many people don't like stocks, and even people that like them are scared of them, and the reason is volatility. That's the downside of stocks. And the claim in that podcast is that volatility is optional, that we can eliminate, or at least virtually eliminate, volatility in the stock market. And what a wonderful, wonderful world that would be. And this, you know, today's podcast is going to be an extension of that idea. But man, oh man, oh man, I believe it's true. I don't believe it with 100% certainty. I'd say, you know, 70-80% certainty, but I do believe it's true. A third one was called Volatility is Evil. And in that one, I just went through, you know, my goal here is to persuade people to get to work, eliminating volatility, instead of all this nonsense, these circular word game arguments about, you know, the efficient market, all this crazy junk, you know, and all this nasty stuff. Get away from that and start doing something constructive. Start, you know, working to restore people's confidence in the stock market and in the U.S. economy and in the U.S. political system and in our hopes for our retirements. And the way to do that is to fight together volatility, the evil thing in the investing world. Volatility is evil. It hurts us, causes busted retirements, causes complexity, causes risk, makes investing just a bad thing, causes inequality. So let's fight that. Causes misallocation of economic resources. So let's fight volatility. Let's get together, and instead of engaging in these nonsense, idiotic word game arguments, let's fight volatility. Well, this is a fourth in that series, and this one is called Volatility Adds Nothing. And in a sane world, I wouldn't have to make this claim, volatility adds nothing. It's like saying cancer adds nothing. Are there really people in favor of volatility? Well, in a sense, there are. When one of these podcasts went up, I think it was the one Volatility is Evil. Maybe I'll pull it up. Maybe I should pull it up, see if I can find it quick. But there's a guy, Evidence-Based Investing. He's one of the goons. He's one of the grainy goons. But when he posts at my site, he tends to post constructively. At the grainy site, he's a goon. But when he posts at my site, you know, he sort of knows I won't tolerate it. And he posts constructively, and he's put forward some good posts. And this was one, and on this particular thread, the Volatility is Evil thread, you can find that at the blog. The blog is called Rich Life. Go to PassionSaving.com, look for the blog, and then look for a blog entry that was called Volatility is Evil, and the date of that was November 20th. And, you know, evidence, he doesn't like it that I'm saying, you know, volatility is optional, we can do with it. You know, he's not happy with that. And of course, that's insane. How can anyone not want to do away with volatility? But you see, this is the way humans are. And if you go through history, I think you will see that as strange as this is, and it is a strange phenomenon, if you go through history, you will find that people do this all the time. In other words, when the Wright brothers were, you know, trying to get an airplane up in the air, you know, a big advance, people put them down. People said, you're stupid. People said, you're wasting your time. People said, you know, you're going to fail. They discouraged them. Same thing when we tried to put a man on the moon. Same thing when, you know, scientists try to cure diseases. Over and over and over again. I remember this when I worked at a small publisher, and there was somebody coming out with a new publication. I think it was Congress Daily, is my recollection. And it had the idea of the publication was, it was a fax publication. So I covered Congress, and other people covered Congress, tax bills. And this Congress Daily they were going to have reporters up on Capitol Hill, just like everybody else. But rather than have them write their articles and have it be delivered the next morning in the newspaper or in a newsletter, whatever, they were going to send it by fax at 3 o'clock in the afternoon so people would get the news quicker. And lobbyists need quick information. So it was a brilliant idea, really. And it had to be kept short, had to be limited to 5 pages. But they put this out, and there were all kinds of people there in the newsroom who were saying, oh, it's never going to work, and this is what's wrong with it, and blah, 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 and blee, blee, blee. And I just remember my boss, you know, the guy who ran the place, and you could just tell from the expression on his face. He had been through this. He had come up with great ideas that people had shot down, and he just was sort of, you know, this is the way people are. This is the way people are. Jealous, envious, and, we'll find out whether it's a good idea or not when it either flies or fails. You know, we'll see. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's not going to work. But we should encourage the new idea. We should want it to work. Now, of course, what's going on here is that people that are in the print media, they're threatened. They're like, oh, wait a minute. I thought I was a big shot. These newcomers are coming along, and they're gonna jump ahead of me in line, and I don't like it. And that's the same thing, I'm sure, that was going on when people made fun of the Wright brothers and the space mission and all these other things. People are threatened by innovations. They're threatened by good developments. Well, the tentative finding, that volatility is optional is of huge benefit to every single human being alive. And yet, evidence-based investing, gives us, and I say, without abusive posting, he was being skeptical. Skepticism is appropriate, so I don't want to be critical of his post here. His posts were actually quite good, and I'm grateful. But the root, the driver, the motivator, it's not so much that he was skeptical. That's a good thing, because you don't want to just say, oh, yeah, new idea, you know, and jump into it. That would be dumb. But, what drives him? What makes him so anxious that he has to shoot this down? What is the driver here? And the driver here is, you know, he bought into buy and hold, and he doesn't want to look stupid, and he's lost a lot of money following buy and hold, and you know, he doesn't want to admit that it was his mistake. You know, I don't think it's anything more than that. So I don't know. I'm not going to read the whole thing. There was too many, but I'll just give a couple. I mean, evidence-based investing. His first post, he just quoted Bill Bernstein from a book Bill Bernstein wrote, The Investor's Manifesto. And I haven't read that book, but I've read earlier books by Bernstein, and this certainly does reflect his views. So I'm sure that it's an accurate quote. But he says, the first paragraph of chapter 2, here's a quote, if you learn nothing else from this book, it should be that risk and return are inextricably intertwined. In almost every country where economists have studied securities returns, stocks have had higher returns than bonds. Further, if you want those high stock returns, you are going to have to pay for them by bearing risk. This is a polite way of saying that in the course of earning those higher returns, your portfolio is going to lose a truckload of money from time to time. Conversely, if you desire perfect safety, resign yourself to low returns. It really cannot be any other way. And I have the greatest respect for Bill Bernstein, but I hereby declare I think Bill Bernstein is wrong. It can be another way. You know, he states the facts accurately. But I think it can be another way. It's our choice. Volatility is optional. So I'll just read my response. I'm not going to read them all, but I'm going to read my response to that one because I think, you know, that one's important. I say, thanks, evidence. You hit the key point on the head with that comment. Bernstein is expressing the conventional wisdom with that claim. He is saying that the reason why stocks provide such a high return is because they are so risky. I disagree. I say that the reason why stocks pay such a high return is because when you buy stocks, you are buying a share in U.S. productivity, and U.S. productivity has long been sufficiently strong to finance a 6.5% real average return. I don't believe that risk has anything to do with it. If we eliminated volatility by educating middle-class investors, Ray, the ABCs of stock investing, and thereby taking emotion out of stock prices, the return on stocks would remain the same, but the risk of stocks would go poof. Non-volatile stocks are non-risky stocks. I have all the respect in the world for Bernstein. I view chapter 2 of the book, Four Pillars of Investing, as the best chapter in any investment book I've ever read, but I believe he is wrong on this risk question, and I believe that his take on risk is in conflict with what he says in chapter 2. If he thought it through more carefully and discussed the realities with lots of other smart and well-intentioned people, he would see the conflicts and develop some wonderful insights. I look forward to the day when we are all working together trying to learn more about how stock investing works in the real world rather than engaging in these petty quarrels, right? Who knew what first and who made what mistake and all this nonsense. I believe that Bill Bernstein, and perhaps evidence-based investing too, is going to be making some wonderful contributions when we get to that magic place where I believe deep in our hearts we all very much want to be. I'm grateful to you for taking the time to stop by and help us all with that link. So Bill Bernstein is saying, if you want high returns, you have to take on risk. And I'm certain he believes it. I don't have any doubt in my mind he believes it. But I don't think he's ever worked through the logic chain carefully enough to know for sure. The truth is, if somebody's going to say, and what I'm trying to argue in this, as I said, I've argued in the earlier podcast that volatility is optional. So there's going to be some overlap here. And I've argued that volatility is evil. And I've argued that volatility is a community effort like pollution, eliminating volatility. What I really want to argue here, though, is, and it's a crazy thing that I have to say it, I want to get it out of people's heads that there's something positive. People are clinging to volatility because that's how they think about stocks. And that's what I want to change, at least as a thought experiment. If you can't buy into the idea that volatility is optional, at least get to a point where you can say, maybe we should hear these people out, or maybe we should think about it, because if we don't open the internet up to honest posting, we're never going to get there. There's lots of money to be made in the stock selling industry pushing buy and hold, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. So there's not much economic incentive there to give accurate investing advice. The internet's very different. Middle-class investors congregate, and middle-class investors, obviously, it's in their best interest to learn how to invest effectively. So we have a great opportunity. We can use this economic crisis as a motivator to learn some things that have not been available to us in earlier days, and to change investing in a very, very positive way. And I wish that the entire Great Safe Withdrawal Rate debate could be focused on this positive side of investing rather than all the negativity of the abusive posting and the board bannings and the death threats and all the sort of thing that the buy and hold dogmatists have brought to the table, unfortunately, in the past 7 years. So, volatility adds nothing. It adds nothing. In other words, stop. What goes on is that people have filters in how they perceive things. And people say, they have a certain mindset. And people have, I don't want to say, if you asked evidence-based investor, if you asked Bill Bernstein, do you think volatility is a good thing? I don't know what they would say. I don't know. If you go by Bernstein's comment there, you almost would think he would say it's a good thing. He says it cannot be any other way. He's saying stocks provide good returns because they are volatile, because they are risky. And he's saying it can't be any other way. And obviously he likes the high returns of stocks. So by implication, he is saying volatility is a good thing. That's what he's saying. And evidence is saying the same thing. Saying, Rob, you're bad. We've got to ban you. We can't let anybody hear you because you're saying to do away with volatility, and volatility is a good thing. And I'm saying, wait a minute, slow down. Are you sure? Are you sure it's a good thing? This came up at a blog I love, the Sci-Fi blog. Not sci-fi like science fiction. It's sci like psychological. PSI. -FI, the Sci-Fi blog. And the guy's name is Tim that writes it. I don't recall his last name, Timothy. I don't know maybe he hasn't said his last name. But he's a fantastic writer, top-notch, and he researches. He doesn't do any cheap blog entries. He puts a lot of research into each one. And he writes on behavioral finance. Does a great job. But he had a blog entry. This was just this morning. I saw it this morning. Maybe he wrote it last night. And goes on and on about risk, how humans relate to risk, how investors relate to risk. And boy, I put up a comment, and I just think his comment, all everything he wrote in the blog was smart, was intelligent. The one frustration I have with that blog, and I've told Tim this, and he's sort of acknowledged it, but I've said, look, you write about this stuff with great insight, but you don't offer solutions. And without a solution, I don't really care to know about the problem. I want problems I can solve. If I can't solve them, I mean, if there are no solutions, the honest thing is to acknowledge that. But it's sort of a frustrating experience to have someone point out all the problems of investor behavior and never offer any solutions. Just say we're doomed. Nothing we can do about it. And on this question, I just said, boy, the solution is staring us in the face. His argument was along the lines of what Bernstein's saying, that risk is what gives us that return. And I said, have you ever really thought this through? Is risk, what if we just did away with risk? What if we just did away with volatility? Then we wouldn't have all this crazy psycho stuff, behavioral problems. It would all go away. Do away with risk, do away with volatility, and you don't need behavioral finance. I mean, you need behavioral finance to do away with it. And that, in my mind, that's what behavioral finance is. I have a podcast, Behavioral Finance 2.0. That's what I think behavioral finance is all about. It's not about writing essays about how humans, engage in logical fallacies. The point of behavioral finance is to stop the bad behavior, to first identify the bad behavior, second, to figure out what motivates it, where it comes from, and then third, deal with that, overcome it so that we invest more effectively. That should be the point of behavioral finance, according to Rob Bennett. And what too many people in this field seem to think it's all about is writing these beautiful essays, explaining everything, never getting anywhere with it. They throw their hands up in the air. They just say, well, we're doomed, and we're not doomed. I had this experience at the, I don't know if I've talked about this yet or not. I don't recall. I just got back from vacation. We went on a week to Myrtle Beach with some friends. It was a nice vacation. It was an unusual one in that usually when we go to the beach, it's all about the beach. It's all about the ocean. And then and this one, it was sort of about everything but the ocean. The ocean was there. We were right on the ocean, but it was too cold for me. My boys went in, children went in, and their boy went in. But for the adults, it was too cold. But we did everything but that. We played card games and we took walks on the beach and we saw beautiful sunrises and sunsets. We had great food and great conversation and all this sort of thing. So it was a nice little time away, but I now don't remember. I was banned at a blog that I like a lot, Behavior Gap, Carl Richards' blog. And boy, what a crazy experience. I think that happened just before I left, and I may have talked about it in an earlier podcast. I'm not sure. I think I may have mentioned it. But, Carl and I, and the same thing recently at Oblivious Investor blog. I was banned there. Another blog I like, Mike Piper. And Mike and I had this long exchange of emails before the ban. We must have exchanged 20 emails, and I'm going to post some at the website, but just crazy stuff. Mike doesn't disagree with anything I say, acknowledges I'm well-intentioned and smart, all this sort of thing. But he's got to ban me because the truth about stock investing upsets his readers. Upsets his readers. Well, that should tell you something. Maybe there's something that they believe, Mike, that's like causing a problem. Same thing with Carl Richards. He says, no problems. He says, I love, he said, I visited your site. He says, valuation informed indexing is just fantastic. I've read everything about it. You're making a huge contribution, Rob. But by the way, I'm banning you. I go, huh? How come you're banning me? Oh, Rob, you say, you tell, I mean, this are my words, not his, but you tell the truth about stock investing, you upset people. Well, why does that upset people? Don't isn't that a problem? If telling people the truth about stock investing upsets them, doesn't that say there's something wrong with the model we're using? Sure seems so to me. Carl's right. I do upset people. It's true. It's objectively true. Mike Piper's right. Mike had people send him emails, and they said, Mike, please ban this Rob Bennett guy. He's upsetting me. You know, he's well intentioned. You know, but I can't bear to read. You gotta protect me from this. And all they'd have to do if they don't like my post is, of course, just skip to another comment. I mean, it's not hard. But they can't take it because they're trying to believe. I mean, I know why. They're trying to believe in buy and hold, and they can't. Their common sense tells them buy and hold doesn't add up. It's gibberish. And yet they want to believe in the worst way. And I keep making all these arguments based on data showing them it doesn't work, and it makes them sick to the stomach. But the answer is not to ban Rob Bennett. The answer is not to ban the historical data. The answer is to, I don't want to say to ban buy and hold, but the answer is to tell people that buy and hold doesn't work. So they get over it. You know, we certainly should be concerned, but concerned about people's feelings, but not so concerned that we don't tell the truth about how they're going to invest the retirement money. Well, I don't want to go off on that riff too much, but the point here is that what we're seeing, is this huge resistance to something that is 100% good, 100% good. Valuation-informed indexing, the rational investing model, 100% good. Every single person benefits. Not everybody's going to follow it, but the ones who don't follow it, the ones who follow it get all the benefits. The ones who don't follow it, they have an option. Certainly not a negative. They have another option. They may not get any direct benefits, but having another option is a benefit. So it's all good. It's all upside, no downside. And yet we have this huge resistance. And so this is what brings the question up. Is there something about volatility that's good? So I'm just going to go through a little bit of the logic chain because I've discussed it on other podcasts. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but I need to repeat it. It's healthy for me to repeat it. So I'm clear in my head about the logic chain, and it's healthy for you to hear it again. And if you haven't heard the other podcast, you'll be lost if I don't do it. But the question is, Bill Bernstein, he says it cannot be any other way. Is there logic in what Bill Bernstein says? There is. What he's saying is, it's a totally logical construct. He's saying, it's this whole theory of the buy and hold model that there's no such thing as a free lunch. You know, you heard that 1,000 times. So what he's saying is, stocks provide higher returns than other asset classes. That's true. And there must be some reason. I mean, that's fair. And stocks are more risky. They're more volatile, so they're more risky. They're more unpredictable. So all those things are true. So you mix all those things together, and you come to this conclusion, in order to get a high return on your investments, you must accept risk. I of course understand where he's coming from. I get that. But these premises have not been examined in sufficient depth. Many of them, they certainly have not been proven. There certainly is no proof of these things. The simple direct route where I can challenge it is to say, okay, you're telling me stocks are more risky, right? Are they? If you follow the buy and hold model, stocks are risky as all get out. I of course agree. Last year we lost about 55%. We've made a lot of it back, but at the low point, stocks were down about 55%. Well, that's risk. Got a lot of money in stocks, you lose 55%. But is that risk? Is that a risk of stocks, or is it a risk of us choosing risk? If you looked at valuation, there are people in this world who look at valuations, not only Rob Bennett. Robert Shiller does it, Rob Arnott does it, Cliff Asness does it, Andrew Smithers does it, John Walter Russell did it, so forth and so on. If you look at valuations, you knew about that risk. How many times did I say on discussion boards, at the valuation levels we're at today, this is before the crash, I'd say at the valuations we're at today, the average price drop from these valuations is 68%. So, you better be ready for a crushing loss. So is that, if you suffered the crushing loss, did you suffer it because of risk? Or did you suffer it because you were just unwilling to question buy and hold? I say it's because you're unwilling to question buy and hold. There was no risk there. Risk would suggest unpredictability. In other words, if you get into your car and you start it up and you slam it into a wall, into a brick wall, and you get injured, is that because cars are risky? Is it because you're a bad driver? If you did it, if the wall's there and you just hit the accelerator, there's no risk there. There's no unpredictability. Anybody with sense can tell you if you slam into a brick wall, you're going to get hurt. Well, if you invest heavily in stocks when they're at the prices that applied from 1996 to 2008, you're going to get hurt. You're going to destroy your chances of retirement. So that's not risk. If we want to be blunt, let's call it stupidity. It's not intellectual stupidity because the people who believe in buy and hold are very smart people as a rule. But it's a mo let's call it emotional, emotional stupidity, whatever you want to call it, emotional incapacity, emotional inability to acknowledge realities of investing, whatever you want to call it. Don't be insulted that I've called you a name. If I can't tell you that it's stupid, how are you ever going to change the behavior? So we have to be frank. We have to call it what it is. It's stupid. To think that stocks can provide good returns at all price levels is stupid. Stupid. Yes, I'm calling John Bogle stupid. Yes, I'm calling Bill Bernstein stupid. Yes, I'm calling Jonathan Clements stupid. You know what? Rob Bennett has been stupid on many things in his life. So join the club, Jonathan Clements. Join the club, William Bernstein. Join the club, John Bogle. We're all humans. We're all stupid. Okay? Get over it. Get over yourselves. You're stupid too. You'll learn a whole lot more about stock investing if you can say that and then move forward. The first step to learning is admitting you're stupid, that you got something wrong. So yes, John Bogle is stupid, says Rob Bennett. So that's not risk. So if you follow, if you pay attention to valuations, are stocks ever risky? The answer to a large extent is no. I mean, we've tested this statistically. John Walter Russell tested this at his website, early-retirement-planning-insights.com, John's website. He did a statistical test. John did a statistical test to find out if you know the PE10 level when you buy stocks, how close are you to knowing everything you need to know the return in 20 years? And the answer is 78%. Stock returns at that point, long-term stock returns, once you look at the PE10 level, are 78% predictable. That means there's 22% unpredictable, which is risk. Unpredictability is risk. So stocks are highly predictable. They're a highly predictable asset class if you're willing to look at valuations. There's nothing to stop you. The information's available on the internet. I've got calculators that spell it all out for you. So if you are investing in stocks in a risky way, whose fault is that? It's your fault. It's the fault of the stock selling industry by, spending hundreds of millions of dollars pushing this buy and hold gibberish. And it's the fault of people on the internet who have banned honest posting, including Mike Piper at his Oblivious Investor blog, including Carl Richards at his wonderful, Mike Piper's wonderful Oblivious Investor blog, and Carl Richards' wonderful Behavior Gap blog, and all these others. So yeah, if you want to blame them, fine, blame them, but you got to blame yourself too. But the point is, Bernstein is starting with a belief that stock investing is risky and it doesn't hold up. If you're willing to look at valuations, if you're willing to blow off the buy and hold model, the risk goes away. So it just doesn't hold up. So at that point, you have to say maybe the other things he says don't hold up either. Is it a fact that stocks provide a higher return? Yes, that's a fact. Is there any reason for believing that's because the reason they tell us why stocks provide a higher return is because stocks are riskier and investors demand a higher return. Is there any evidence that investors demand a higher return? Zero. No evidence of that whatsoever. I always bring up the example in January 2000, Stocks were paying the expected long-term return on stock, the expected 10-year return on stocks was negative 1% per year, real. And tips were paying 4% real, differential of 5 percentage points, and 90% of investors were heavily invested in stocks at a time when they were paying 5 percentage points less for 10 years running. They were taking a 50% reduction in their life savings. And you're telling me these people are demanding return for risk? Where is the evidence for this stuff? In this artificial world of buy and hold, it quote-unquote makes sense. It does logically follow. You would think they would demand a return. But what they're leaving out is that investors are emotional and they don't know what the heck they're doing. And the stock selling industry wants them to buy stocks. So they generate these foolish theories and spend hundreds of millions of dollars advertising them, and people believe them. People believe what they hear on television and on the radio and in newspapers. Surprise, surprise. Got nothing to do with risk. Has to do with the stock selling industry trying to make a buck. Nothing to do with risk. Is it true that bonds pay less than stocks? Yes. But that doesn't mean that doesn't follow that stocks are risky. Stocks pay 6.5%, I believe, because when you own stocks, when you own a broad index, what you own is a share of the productivity of the U.S. economy. And the U.S. economy has been a highly productive economy for many, many years. And a highly productive economy generates enough profits so that all the owners can enjoy a return of 6.5 real on average per year. That's all. Simple. I don't think it's any more complicated than that. It's really simple. Really, 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 really simple. No risk. There's no risk. You're buying a share of something that provides 6.5 real, so you get 6.5 real. Why do bonds pay less? That may be due to market negotiations. I believe that in that case, the companies that issue bonds, they issue the bonds at a price. They offer a return in order to attract people to buy the bonds. And bonds are perceived as less risky than stocks, less volatile than stocks, certainly. And so people say, hey, I'm willing to, if stocks pay 6.5, I'm willing to take 4% in a bond. Well, fine. So they get 4. So the company says, we'll pay you 4% or 4.5 or whatever it happens to be. Fine. So if you want to say market forces determine the price on the bonds, fine. But that doesn't mean that market forces determine the price on the stocks. There's no market negotiation determining the price on the stocks. The return on the stocks. The return on the stock is set by productivity of the U.S. economy, not by investors demanding. There is no such process, says Rob Bennett, tentatively. So stocks do not have to be risky. Do not have to be risky. Stocks do not have to be risky. I'm going to keep saying it. Risk is optional. Volatility is optional. We choose to make stocks risky. Now, how do we make stocks risky? What is it we do? What we do is we promote buy and hold. We promote the idea that price doesn't matter. In a rational world, investors would, of course, lower their stock allocations when prices got high because the return drops. It may be 6.5 when you buy at normal prices, at reasonable prices. But when you buy at 3 times fair value, the return on stocks isn't 6.5. It's a negative 1% for the long term. So obviously, in a rational world, people would lower their stock allocation when the long-term return is a negative 1%. But if they don't do that, if they're taught not to do that, and we have spent 30 years shoving it, this buy and hold gibberish down people's throats, if people are taught not to do that, what happens? Then you have volatility. In two directions. You have volatility in an upward direction, because if you tell people prices don't, if you tell people valuations don't matter, what's going to happen? Everyone's going to bid the price of stocks up, so that, because if volatility doesn't matter, a 20% return is a good thing. You see, in a rational world, a 20% return is a bad thing because that means returns in the future are going to drop. So in a rational world, any return higher than 6.5 is a negative. But in a buy and hold world, 20% return is beautiful because you keep the 20% and you still expect 6% going forward. So it's like voting yourself a raise. So obviously, if you promote buy and hold, you're going to have huge volatility on the upside. As we did, we promoted volatility and we promoted buy and hold in the 80s and 90s. And look what we got. We got stock prices three times fair value. And you're also going to have huge volatility on the downside. Why? Because common sense tells us that buy and hold can't work in the long term. Come on. Where'd the money come from? You're making 20%, 30% a year. Where the heck did the money come from? We all have common sense. We've all bought things other than stocks. We know that price matters. We know that this idea that stocks could always be best for the long run is a fantasy on some level of consciousness. So while we participate in this idiot volatility going up, it scares us to death. We're going to lose all our money. We're going to lose our life savings. So then we see, you know, it starts to hit us. Hey, stocks are going to collapse. Stock prices are going to collapse. And then we sell. Then we panic. Then you got volatility on the downside. So as long as we promote the idea that price doesn't matter, as long as we promote buy and hold, we're going to have huge upside volatility and huge downside volatility. And what does it get us? It gets us nothing. Big fat zero. Volatility is evil. Volatility is optional. Volatility is evil. Volatility adds nothing. If we educated people about the realities of stock investing, volatility would go poof. The stock price would reflect the long-term dividend stream from stocks, which justifies a 6.5% gain per year. And stocks would always return something close to 6.5. There would not be any volatility. That's not volatility. That's an increase in price, but it's a stable valuation level, a stable PE10 level of 14. If you just keep the PE10 level the same, you would have a 6.5 return. Because the 6.5 return that's your payoff for owning a share of U.S. productivity. But the idea, the pushback we're getting, is that trying to eliminate volatility is a bad thing because somehow volatility is good. Somehow volatility is what produces these good returns. And I say no. Volatility has nothing to do with it. Risk has nothing to do with it. Stock returns are a product of the economic gains of the U.S. economy. You're just sharing in those profits. Volatility adds nothing. Volatility adds nothing good. It adds a lot bad. It adds risk. Volatility makes stocks risky. Does that. Volatility makes stocks confusing. This is why people can't understand stock investing, because this volatility makes you crazy. But if we do away with buy and hold, we do away with volatility. We kill it in its tracks. Now, we should be having a national debate on these issues. We should be trying to find out the realities. I'm telling you the realities as I see them. I'm not God. I never went to investing school. Never managed a big fund. I'm some guy who posts on the internet. So don't take what I say as gospel. But I think you'd be smart to go to your discussion board, whichever one it is that I've been banned from, go to Oblivious Investor and ask, is volatility add anything, Mike Piper, in your opinion? Go to Carl Richards' blog, Behavior Gap. Does volatility add anything, Carl Richards? Go to Bogleheads and ask John Bogle. Does volatility add anything, John Bogle? Go to Bill Bernstein. Send him an email. He answers emails. Bill Bernstein, you say it's got to be this way. Can't have good returns without risk, without volatility. Why? Why do you believe that? What if we educated investors? What if we allowed honest posting on the internet? Why wouldn't the stock price reflect the dividend stream, the present value of the long-term dividend stream, which is what people knowledgeable in this field believe it represents? That's what Warren Buffett says it represents. If it represents the long-term dividend stream, it shouldn't be jumping all around. The long-term dividend stream is determined by the profitability, the productivity of the U.S. economy. That's a stable number, not a changing number. It's been 6.5 for a long, 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 long time. Why would you think that would jump up and down in these crazy ways that we saw last year, that we see all the time, really? We saw this year. Crazy volatility again this year. People are happy about it this year because it's going up instead of down. It's still volatility. It's still crazy. This is the mistake. This is how you get trapped. You see it going up and you get to like it. It's a gambler's disease. It goes up and you say, yeah, 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 I like it. Then it takes all your money away. And it's the same thing on the downside as on the upside. It's irrational. It's crazy volatility, crazy risk, unnecessary volatility, unnecessary risk. What everyone in this field should be doing is trying to eliminate volatility. And the way to do that, there's nothing we can do to the stocks. The stocks just are what they are. What we have to change is investor behavior. And the only way we change investor behavior is by educating investors about the realities of stock investing. That's what we got to do. And of course, we can't do that unless we can post honestly. It's pretty much impossible. If you can't speak, you can't educate. Mindlessness is not the answer. Mindlessness is not the answer. Well, I want to sum up. I want to make one last point on the volatility point. I've made various points. Volatility is optional. Volatility is evil. Volatility adds nothing. And volatility is like pollution. Volatility is a community. Eliminating volatility is a community effort. Those are the four main points in the four podcasts. But I want to sum up where we are in the state of knowledge of investing in December 2009, according to your friend, Rob Bennett. Here's what I believe, and these are rough numbers, but, you know, very rough numbers. But here's what I believe. As we snap these final pieces of the puzzle into place. I think of investing before the buy and hold era. I should probably call it the pre-buy and hold era. I think of it as the pre-Bogle era, but whatever you want to call it, pre-passive investing era. All the years up to say, let's say 1970. All the years up to 1970, because in 1974 came Random Walk Down Wall Street, Burton Malkiel's book that popularized the buy and hold concept. I think it was 76 when Bogle founded Vanguard, which gave people funds, you know, to achieve, you know, to follow this approach. And the research was done in the 50s and 60s by Eugene Fama and lots of other people. So let's say 1960 if you want it. 1960, somewhere in the 1960s, we entered the buy and hold era. But it didn't really become popularized until the 70s. So academics took it up in the 60s. Became popular in the 70s or went mainstream, let's say, in the 70s, and then really became popular in the 80s and 90s with the huge bull market. I would say in the pre-Bogle era, the pre-buy-and-hold era, we knew 25% of what there is to know about stock investing. I argue in an earlier podcast from a long time ago, the state of knowledge of stock investing today is primitive. So I'm saying that up until 1960, 1970, we knew 25% of what there is to know. We knew almost nothing. We were essentially in the dark ages. We were just sort of hunting around in the dark. We didn't know what we were doing. There were people who did well. There were people who did poorly. Even the ones who did, you know, there's a story of a guy who did well. I don't know if I can remember his name now. He's a famous guy. Taylor Livermore? The guy who wrote the Boglehead's Guide is Taylor Larimore, and the famous guy had a name similar to that, something like Taylor Livermore, but that doesn't sound quite right. But anyway, he wrote a famous book about investing, but he made a fortune in stocks and then lost it. You know, I mean, so is he smart or is he dumb? I mean, you know, he's smart enough to make a fortune, he's dumb enough to lose it. So I don't know. But he was about as smart as you could get. So I would describe that pre-buy and hold era. I would say that we knew essentially 25% of what there is to know about investing. Now, the Bogle slash buy and hold era slash passive investing era added to our knowledge investing immeasurably. I would say it doubled it. All the insights that were mined in the 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s were of huge value. I say that all the time. I had a podcast not too long ago where I tried to pay tribute to the people who developed passive investing because I put it down so often. I felt that in fairness I should express some gratitude. I would say in rough terms, we doubled our knowledge of investing. We made it scientific. We started to systematize the accumulation of knowledge of investing. So that's exciting. That was a big advance. Now, there was a big flaw. The big flaw was buy and hold. The big flaw was this idea that the market's immediately efficient. I've talked about this on earlier podcasts, but the big mistake the academics made, they were right that the market is efficient, but they were wrong that it takes place, that efficiency takes place immediately. The reality, as revealed by the historical data, at least according to my eyes, is that the market is gradually efficient. It's always in the process of becoming efficient, but it takes about 10 years for a significant degree of efficiency to kick in, 20 years for a high degree of efficiency to kick in. So in 1 year, stocks are totally inefficient, or 2 years, 3 years. But in 10 years, good bit of efficiency. 20 years, high, 20 years, like I said, 78% predictability. So you've got a high degree of efficiency. But that one mistake, thinking that efficiency was immediate rather than gradual, means that that whole model, if you get the basics wrong, you get everything wrong. So that one mistake meant that every strategic recommendation made in the buy and hold model was the opposite of what works. So we've basically destroyed the U.S. economic system, and destroying the U.S. economic system has caused a lot of destruction to the U.S. political system as well. People have lost confidence in our leaders because our leaders have done nothing about it. It's gone on and on. For 30 years, Shiller's research showing that valuations affect long-term returns came out in 1981. It's now 2009, soon be 2010, 29 years. So what happened is, we went from knowledge of 25% to knowledge of 50%, which on the surface is a good thing, but we increased our arrogance ratio, by a factor of 50. People used to not know a lot, but they knew they didn't know a lot, so they invested in stocks sort of cautiously. And they got burned every now and again. Certainly in the Depression, people got burned. But outside of the Depression, they generally didn't get burned too awfully bad. But with the buy and hold era, people thought that they had learned it all. They had really gotten up to 50% knowledge, but they thought that they were gods walking the earth. They became arrogant to just a sickening degree, truly a sickening degree. And as a result, I think the Bogle buy and hold era will be looked upon as I don't want to say it'll be looked upon as a negative. I hope that people will see the positive in it. But it's going to cause more, I believe, it's going to cause more human misery than any other mistake ever made in the history of personal finance. So the damage done was just an awesome thing to behold. We got so full of ourselves that we've destroyed ourselves. Sometimes, the saying is a little knowledge is dangerous. So Bogle and all the promoters of buy and hold gave us a little knowledge, but by not giving us enough to invest effectively, what they did was they made investing more dangerous than it had ever been before. Because in the old days, at least people were cautious. They didn't invest the money they needed in the stock market, at least if they had sense, they didn't. But in the 80s and 90s and 2000s, middle-class people who can't afford losses of 70% started putting all their money in stocks. At a time when prices were so high that a 70% loss was virtually inevitable. So we've seen huge, huge losses, and we're likely to see much more in days to come. Now, stage three is what I'd call the valuation-informed indexing error. And you know, I don't want to take credit for this. I mean, I think I'll take credit. You know, others will decide how much credit I'm entitled to. You know, my views are informed by the views of lots of smart people, you know, including John Bogle, to be sure, Warren Buffett, Andrew Smithers, Robert Shiller, Bill Bernstein, you know, on and on and on and on. Rob Arnott, John Walter Russell, all these people. So I'm just the guy on the internet that, you know, was placed in circumstances where he had to learn the realities of stock investing to save his discussion board community. And I looked all this stuff up and sort of incorporated it and I think made some logical jumps that hadn't been made by others. I think I've made some logical jumps that have not been made by others. So I've added something, but certainly it was, you know, not a one-man show. I never want anyone to say that I've said that. That would be preposterous. So, but I call this, I think of this as the valuation-informed indexing era. The era where we developed a model of how to invest that permits the middle-class investor to avoid most of the risk of stock investing. If you become a valuation-informed indexer, lots of materials on valuation-informed indexing at the site, you can invest in stocks, you can get all the upside, the big returns, while eliminating most, you know, 80% of the downside. Pretty good deal, I think. So I would say that that took us, by incorporating the valuation slash emotion side of investing into the picture, we added another 25% knowledge. We went to 75% knowledge. So that's enough to overcome the risk of the buy and hold era. Get us back to where we were pre-Bogle, but with the added knowledge. So it's actually a plus. It takes the Bogle... the Bogle ideas and makes them positive, turns them from negative energy into positive energy. Sort of makes, the way I'd put it is, it makes indexing workable. Indexing was not workable without changing your allocation, without understanding the need to change your allocation. Valuation-informed indexing says, yes, index by all means. Keep investing simple for the middle-class investor, but you must change your allocation. You'd be insane not to change your allocation when prices go to, you know, insanely dangerous levels. So that got us to 75%. The stuff I'm talking about on these four podcasts on volatility takes us into the future of investing, which, as I say, it's tentative today. I'm putting down these ideas, but we can't, I think you can go with valuation-informed indexing today. You should be skeptical. You should look for caveats. But because it all can be checked with data, I personally am comfortable investing that way today, even though there hasn't been as much discussion of it as I would like to hear. There's been some, but not as much as I would like. This fourth stage, the future of investing, you know, putting the final pieces into the puzzle, that's a stage where I don't know that we can say this with confidence today until there's been a national debate where smart people, look at the things I'm saying here and you know, challenge them, find out whether they hold up to scrutiny. But if we get there, I think that would take us ultimately, it might take 10 years, but it would ultimately take us the other 25%. I don't know that we'll ever get to 100% knowledge of investing, but I think it's possible we can get to 90%, something in that neighborhood, in the not-too-distant future. Because what this is about is more than just valuation-informed indexing. Valuation-informed indexing is an approach to investing for the individual investor that allows you to protect yourself from the risk of overvaluation, the risk of the buy-and-hold approach. These new ideas are community ideas, and the ideas here are not just to protect yourself from risk, but to essentially take risk out of stock investing. And that's, of course, never been done. It's a shockingly bold idea. I don't dispute that. What I dispute is this idea that it's not worth pursuing. I don't care how bold it is. If it works, let's do it. The idea of the Wright brothers, you know, putting a plane in the air was a bold idea. The idea of, you know, John Kennedy putting a man on the moon was a bold idea. The idea of, you know, penicillin or anesthesia, these were bold ideas. Lots of bold ideas in the world. You know, If the idea doesn't work, let's drop it by all means. Stupid. But if it works, let's do it. And to say, well, nobody's ever done it before, that to me is not an argument. That to me is not an argument at all. It's grounds for skepticism. I have no problem with skepticism. I think that's healthy. But it's not an argument for not doing it. So I think evidence-based investor, he made good comments in that thread. I'm grateful for his contribution. I think his attitude leaves something to be desired. What I'd like is challenge, intellectual challenge. But I think we should be approaching this in a spirit of let's find out, does it work or not? Because if it works, we want to embrace it. We don't want to say, oh, I didn't think it up, so it's bad, and I don't want anybody else to know about it. That is moronic. And if Bill Bernstein has it wrong when he says there's no way you can get good returns from stocks without stocks being risky, if he's wrong, I believe he's wrong. I hope and pray that Bill Bernstein will have the grace to acknowledge first that maybe he's wrong. That's how the debate gets started. And ultimately, if the national debate shows that in fact he is wrong, that he is wrong, that he could step to the plate and say, you know what? When I wrote that paragraph in that book, I really thought it was true. Now I've been engaged in this great debate, and I have doubts. Not so sure anymore. Maybe Rob is right. Maybe you can get the returns in stocks without the risk. The returns without the risk. Let's stop this small-minded thinking. This catchphrase. There's no such thing as a free lunch. Rubs my fur the wrong way because the argument I make is life itself is a free lunch. Was it a free lunch when the Wright brothers invented the airplane? If John Bogle were in charge of the world, he would have said, oh, that would be a free lunch to fly. Gotta smash that plane to pieces. We can't fly. To pass a law so nobody can invent airplanes. Learning how to fly was a free lunch. Discovering penicillin, for use in curing disease was a free lunch. Freedom of the press is a free lunch. Constitution of the United States. Look, it's brought us wonderful things, in my opinion. I'm a journalist. Free lunch. There's free lunches everywhere you turn. And what's holding us back is this, I do think it's moronic, so I'm going to say it, this moronic idea that our knowledge of investing can never advance. That's what that phrase has come to mean. Every time someone comes up with a huge advance in our understanding of how stock investing works, some boglehead steps forward and says, oh, if that were true, it would be a free lunch. So we must ban discussion of it. That's a know-nothing attitude. It's a dangerous attitude. It's a sick attitude. It's a subhuman attitude. There is such a thing as a free lunch. All learning is a free lunch. And learning's what I'm all about. It's the reason I got on the internet first time I did. It's the reason I built the Retire Early Board at Motley Fool. So I believe in a free lunch. I believe stocks are a wonderful investment class. The only negative that I see is volatility, and that's optional. And I'd like to see us all get together to bury stock volatility 10 feet in the ground where it can never hurt us again, where we can all enjoy the high returns of stocks without the high volatility, without the high risk. Volatility adds nothing to this picture. Volatility adds nothing. The rational investor is the anti-volatility investor. I look forward to the day we're all working together to get to this better place, this place that I believe deep in our hearts is where we all want to be. Good luck with your investing strategy.